back during the war, we used to see these planes going back and forth. As a matter of fact, there was a lot of bombs dumped into the Bordeaux Lakes. Kerry Long informed me of what compounds that these bombs had, because in a lot of our observations, we used to see a lot of unusual lesions in some of these aquatic life. Personally, I've had 6-7 members of my immediate family that have died from various strains of cancer. And even as we speak, I have a granddaughter at the Children's Hospital in Halifax with cancer. Bordeaux Lakes has been a lifeline for our people for so long. Factoring our 7 generations, we have to also ensure that our future generations will also have the same privileges as we have today.
Canadian authorities had never admitted that chemical weapons were dumped in the Bordeaux Lakes, but they haven't denied it either, and for Terry Long, that silence speaks volumes. Concerns that dump sites cannot be cleaned up without injury to humans and damage to the environment has hindered such efforts. But Japanese officials, pushed by economic interests, decided to move ahead. They founded the first industrial program to clean up chemical weapons in the seas. Imperial Japan produced large quantities of weapons containing mustard gas and lewisite in the 1930s. They used them against civilians during the invasion of Manchuria in 1937, killing thousands. Poison gases were produced here at Okunoshima Island. The work was so secret the island was removed from Japanese maps during World War II. Today the island is called Bunny Island. The bombs in the Kanda port lie just 10 meters deep, and the Japanese government negotiated a contract with Kobelco, a giant steel corporation, to clear the weapons and destroy them. Kobelco technology is beginning to interest other countries like the United States, Belgium, and France. The Kanda experience and Kobelco's cutting-edge research with underwater robotics demonstrates safe cleanups can be conducted in depths of up to 150 meters safely for humans and the environment. 1 million tons of chemical weapons lie in the depths of the seas. Some have been there for more than 70 years now. Most countries clearly don't want to take responsibility for cleaning up their own weapons. And many other munitions belong to no country. For example, who will pay for the weapons made by Germany during World War II and dumped by the Allies? The Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons, which won the 2013 Nobel Peace Prize, has a mandate to end the spread of chemical weapons around the globe. Since 1992, 190 countries have signed the convention prohibiting chemical weapons. However, the OPCW has never taken a stance on the issue of munitions dumped in the sea. Terry Long, with the support of Baltic state officials, brought his group and the problem to The Hague last spring to urge the organization to support cleanup efforts.
Good afternoon. I'd like to welcome everybody here today to this side event at the LIPA room. My name is Terence Patrick Long. I'm the chairman of the International Dialogue on Underwater Munitions. What is desperately needed is ownership and leadership and the coordination of international efforts to adequately address sea dump chemical munitions.
We think that time is really ripe to act because weapons are surfacing and calling for action. We are truly convinced that the member state of the OPCW will finally listen to us.
Every now and then people are asking us, is the leakage increasing or not, or is the environmental damage ongoing? we cannot answer them with the degree of certainty we would like to have.
The worldwide dumping of CDUMP chemical munitions by the international community was a mistake. We all seriously need to accept the obvious, that substances that are too toxic to touch with the ungloved hand has no place in our marine environment.
It's urgent that scientists be free to continue their research. The military secrecy imposed by the Allies since the Potsdam Conference in 1945 must be lifted. This is essential to effectively evaluate the risks these weapons pose to man, the environment, and the food chain.
That the states involved in creating this disaster will finally clean up and take responsibility for their previous actions before it is too late and the legacy of the world wars takes its toll on the world's next generation. Let's wait and see. And that's it for this week. Thank you. Do join me again next time here on Aperture. Goodbye for now.
In the limelight.
The Silicon Valley Bank and its nearly $175 billion in deposits have been put under government control. It's the largest U.S. bank to fail since the 2008 financial crisis. We take a look at the U.S. media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The website of CNBC has covered this story and tells us more. Financial regulators have closed Silicon Valley Bank and taken control of its deposits. The Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation announced on Friday, 10th of March, in what is the largest U.S. bank failure since the global financial crisis more than a decade ago. The collapse of Silicon Valley Bank, SVB, a key player in the technology and venture capital community, leaves companies and wealthy individuals largely unsure of what will happen to their money. According to press releases from regulators, the California Department of Financial Protection and Innovation closed Silicon Valley Bank and named the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation as the receiver. The Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, in turn, has created the Deposit Insurance National Bank of Santa Clara, which now holds the insured deposits from SVB. The Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation said in the announcement that insured depositors will have access to their deposits no later than Monday morning. SVB's branch offices will also reopen at that time under the control of the regulator. According to the press release, SVB's official checks will continue to clear. The Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation's standard insurance covers up to $250,000 per depositor per bank for each account ownership category. The Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation said uninsured depositors will get receivership certificates for their balances. The regulator said it will pay uninsured depositors an advance dividend within the next week, with potential additional dividend payments as the regulator sells SVB's assets. Whether depositors with more than $250,000 ultimately get all of their money back will be determined by the amount of money the regulator gets as it sells Silicon Valley assets or if another bank takes ownership of the remaining assets. There were concerns in the technology community that until that process unfolds, some companies may have issues making payroll. As the end of December, SVB had roughly $209 billion in total assets and $175.4 billion in total deposits, according to the press release. The Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation said it was unclear what portion of those deposits were above the insurance limit. The last U.S. bank failure of this size was Washington Mutual in 2008, which had $307 billion in assets. Silicon Valley Bank was a major bank for the venture-backed companies, which were already under pressure due to higher interest rates and a slowdown for initial public offerings that made it more difficult to raise additional cash. The closure of Silicon Valley Bank, SVB, would impact not only the deposits but also credit facilities and other forms of financing. The Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation said loan customers of SVB should continue to make their payments as normal. The move represents a rapid downfall for SVB. On Wednesday, 8th of March, the bank announced it was looking to raise more than $2 billion in additional capital after suffering a $1.8 billion loss on asset sales. The shares of parent company SVB Financial Group fell 60% on Thursday, 9th of March, and dropped another 60% in pre-market trading on Friday, 10th of March, before being halted. CNBC's David Faber reported Friday morning that their efforts to raise capital had failed and that SVB had pivoted towards a potential sale. However, a rapid outflow of deposits was complicating the sale process. While many Wall Street analysts have argued that the struggles for Silicon Valley Bank are unlikely to spread to the broader banking system, shares of other mid-sized and regional banks came under pressure on Friday. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen said during testimony before the House Ways and Means Committee on Friday morning that she was monitoring very carefully developments at a few banks. Janet Yellen made her comments before the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation's announcement. Shortly after leaving Capitol Hill, Janet Yellen convened a meeting of top officials at the Fed, the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, and the Comptroller of the Currency specifically to discuss the situation at the Silicon Valley Bank. The Associated Press has also covered the story and tells us more. Regulators rushed on Friday, 10th of March, to seize the assets of one of the Silicon Valley's top banks, marking the largest failure of a U.S. financial institution since the height of the financial crisis almost 15 years ago. Silicon Valley Bank, the nation's 16th largest bank, failed after depositors hurried to withdraw money this week amid anxiety over the bank's health. It was the second biggest bank failure in U.S. history after the collapse of Washington Mutual in 2008. The bank served mostly technology workers and venture capital-backed companies, including some of the industry's best-known brands. "This is an extinction-level event for startups," said Gary Tan, the chief executive officer of Y Combinator, a startup incubator that launched Airbnb, DoorDash, and Dropbox, and has referred hundreds of entrepreneurs to the bank. "I literally have been hearing from hundreds of our founders asking for help on how they can get through this. They're asking, do I have to furlough my workers?" There appeared to be little chance of the chaos spreading to the broader banking sector as it did in the months leading up to the Great Recession. The biggest banks, those most likely to cause an economic meltdown, have healthy balance sheets and plenty of capital. Nearly half of the U.S. technology and healthcare companies that went public last year after getting early funding from venture capital firms were Silicon Valley Bank customers, according to the bank's website. The bank also boasted of its connections to leading technology companies such as Shopify, ZipRecruiter and one of the top venture capital firms, Andreessen Horowitz. Tan estimated that nearly one-third of Y Combinator startups will not be able to make payroll at some point over the next month if they cannot access their money. Internet television provider Roku was among casualties of the bank collapse. It said in a regulatory filing on Friday that about 26% of its cash, or $487 million, was deposited at the Silicon Valley Bank. Roku said its deposits with Silicon Valley Bank were largely uninsured, and it didn't know to what extent it will be able to recover those funds. As part of the seizure, California bank regulators and the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation transferred the bank's assets to a newly created institution, the Deposit Insurance Bank of Santa Clara. The new bank will start paying out insured deposits on Monday. Then the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation and California regulators plan to sell off the rest of the assets to make other depositors whole. There was unease in the banking sector all week, with shares tumbling by double digits. The news of Silicon Valley Bank's distress pushed shares of almost all financial institutions even lower on Friday, 10th of March. The failure arrived with incredible speed. Some industry analysts suggested on Friday that the bank was still a good company and a wise investment. Meanwhile, Silicon Valley Bank executives were trying to raise capital and find additional investors. However, trading in the bank's shares was halted before stock markets opening bell due to extreme volatility. Shortly before noon, the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation moved to shutter the bank. Notably, the agency did not wait until the close of business, which is the typical approach. The Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation could not immediately find a buyer for the bank's assets, signaling how fast depositors cashed out. The White House said Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen was watching closely what was happening at the bank. The administration sought to reassure the public that the banking system is much healthier than during the Great Recession. Our banking system is in a fundamentally different place than it was a decade ago, said Cecilia Ruse, chair of the White House Council of Economic Advisers. Cecilia Ruse added the reforms that were put in place back then really provide the kind of resilience that we'd like to see.
Option for today and a better tomorrow. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
France has been hit by yet another wave of mass strikes and protests. The row is about President Emmanuel Macron's controversial pension reforms. An estimated 1.28 million people have participated in the nationwide strike. The demonstrations were some of the biggest in decades. The nationwide strike have disrupted train services, shut schools, and halted fuel deliveries. Unions have stepped up their campaign to force a U-turn on a deeply unpopular policy. Workers from different sectors have walked out of their jobs and held demonstrations in Paris and other cities. Refineries have stopped fuel deliveries, most trains have come to a halt, and power production has decreased during the industrial action. Some scuffles have broken out on the sidelines, with some people throwing projectiles at police who responded with tear gas. Unions have threatened to freeze up the economy with work stoppages. Some unions have called for open-ended strikes in sectors from refineries and oil depots to electricity and gas facilities. This is the sixth time since the start of the year that unions called a nationwide day of strikes and demonstrations. The disruption is expected to be greater and last longer as rail unions call for rolling open-ended strikes. This could affect all national trains as well as international routes. Trains to Germany and Spain came to a halt, and those to and from the United Kingdom and Belgium were reduced by a third. Some students have also blockaded faculties, and some schools closed as teachers staged a one-day strike.
I don't want to work until I'm 64. I say to myself, enough already. For the moment, there are only promises made and we don't know when it's going to end. So it's better to fight now than to lose our gains. That's it.
People are fed up. People are exhausted. People see around them that there are plenty of colleagues who don't even make it to the current legal retirement age. So how can we expect them to make it to 64? And then, for us, it's 64. But for the years to come and our children, what age will it be? 66? I think the government hasn't taken everything into account.
The strikes and industrial actions are about President Emmanuel Macron's unpopular pension reforms. His government is planning to raise the retirement age from 62 to 64 and increase the number of years of work required to claim a full pension. The change will be gradual, increasing by 3 months per year from September until 2030. From 2027, workers will have to make social security contributions over 43 years rather than 42 in order to get full pensions. The government says the reforms would boost the employment rate among 60 to 64-year-olds. In France, the employment rate in this age category is just 33% compared with 61% in Germany and 69% in Sweden.
Precisely, it is the most precarious people who are going to suffer the most from the reform and who are going to serve two more years. It is scandalous. Mrs. Bourne has never been a cleaning lady. She has never been a social worker for handicapped kids. She has never done work where you have to get up at 6 o'clock in the morning to go to work with cut-off hours, to work on Saturday nights, on Sundays. She does not know at all. She doesn't know what the people and the population go through. So yes, it is scandalous.
Macron has vowed to go ahead with the bill. The reforms were at the heart of the President Emmanuel Macron's re-election campaign last year, but are proving deeply unpopular. His cabinet says the changes are essential to prevent the pension system from falling into deficit and younger people carrying the burden. Macron's centralist alliance has the most seats in the National Assembly but lost its majority in legislative elections last year. Therefore, it needs to count on the support from the right to be able to pass the bill. Another option for the government would be to use a special constitutional power to force the bill through without a vote. This is a risky choice because such a decision would be highly unpopular.
Since the war in Syria began in early 2011, Western nations and their regional allies have left no stones unturned to topple the Syrian government. These efforts were led by the U.S., which coordinated the efforts of the Western and Arab nations against Damascus. but the U.S. soon began to dispatch its own soldiers and military hardware to the war-stricken nation. The U.S. claimed that the troops sent to Syria were tasked with fighting Daesh terrorists and helped the so-called moderate armed opponents of President Bashar al-Assad. Daesh terrorists were defeated mainly due to the efforts of the resistance front, and U.S.-backed efforts to topple the government in Damascus largely failed. But the U.S. still continues to keep hundreds of its troops in northeast Syria. Over the years, U.S. forces have been involved in the theft of Syria's natural resources, including its oil.
Very importantly, as you know, we have the oil, and we left soldiers for the oil because we took the oil and we're working on that, and we have it very nicely secured.
We've kept the oil. We stayed back and kept the oil. Other people can patrol the border of Syria, frankly, and Turkey, let them, they've been fighting for 1,000 years. Let them do the border. We don't want to do that. We want to bring our soldiers home. But we did leave soldiers because we're keeping the oil. I like oil. We're keeping the oil.
The U.S. regime is also using its troops in that region to coordinate anti-Damascus efforts with the Kurdish militants. By backing the Kurdish-led SDF in eastern Syria, the U.S. controls about a third of the country, an area where most of Syria's oil fields are located. Just recently, the U.S. Chairman of the Joint Chief of Staff, Mark Milley, visited Syria, marking his first visit to the country as a top U.S. general. Damascus condemned the visit as, quote, illegal and a flagrant violation of Syria's sovereignty. Calls are now growing to end the illegal presence in Syria. A resolution was circulated in the U.S. House of Representatives, which called for the withdrawal of U.S. troops from Syria. The resolution was submitted by Republican Matt Gaetz and was supported by other Republican lawmakers. The resolution was ultimately defeated by Congress, but it could be a signal of growing uneasiness with the presence of U.S. troops in the war-torn nation.
I do not believe that what stands between a caliphate and not a caliphate are the 900 Americans who have been sent to this hellscape with no definition of victory, with no clear objective, and purely existing as a vestige to the regime change, failed foreign policies of multiple former presidents.
Syria is not the only country in West Asia that hosts unwanted U.S. troops. Syria's neighbor Iraq is also home to hundreds of U.S. soldiers. Earlier this week, the Pentagon chief made an unannounced visit to Iraq, where he announced Washington's intent to maintain its military presence there. Austin is the most senior official in the Biden administration to visit the country. The presence of U.S. troops in Iraq began in 2003, after Washington invaded the country. March 19, 2003, the U.S. and Britain invaded Iraq in blatant violation of international law under the pretext of finding weapons of mass destruction. But no such weapons were ever discovered in Iraq.
The objective is to compel Iraq to destroy its illegal weapons of mass destruction and its program to develop and produce missiles and more of those weapons. Saddam is dangerous. The world would be a better place without him. But the reason he poses a growing danger to the United States and its allies is that he possesses chemical and biological weapons and is seeking nuclear weapons.
And unlike my colleague from West Virginia and Maryland, I do not believe this is a rush to war. I believe it's a march to peace and security.
Indeed, the facts and Iraq's behavior show that Saddam Hussein and his regime are concealing their efforts to produce more weapons of mass destruction.
At this hour, American and coalition forces are in the early stages of military operations to disarm Iraq, to free its people, and to defend the world from grave danger.
According to the California-based investigative organization Project Censored, more than 1 million Iraqis were killed as a result of the U.S.-led invasion and occupation of the country. The U.S. withdrew its forces in 2011, claiming that it had ended its combat mission in Iraq. But hundreds of U.S. troops still remain inside the Arab country on what Washington describes as an advisory mission. Following the U.S. assassination of Iran's anti-terror commander, General Qasem Soleimani, and his Iraqi trench mate, Abu Mahdi al-Mohandas, Iraqi parliament passed a resolution that called for the withdrawal of all U.S. troops from the country. However, Washington kept its force inside the country in defiance of a resolution. The U.S. military declared the end of its combat mission in Iraq in December 2021, but it still maintains a number of troops there under the guise of playing an advisory and training role.
Chinese President Xi Jinping has strongly censured the U.S. in a speech at an annual summit of the ruling Communist Party. He said Washington is leading a campaign to suppress and contain China's development. Xi, who will begin his third consecutive term as the country's president, said Beijing faces unprecedented challenges from the West.
Western countries led by the United States have implemented all-round containment, encirclement, and suppression of China, which has brought unprecedented severe challenges to our country's development.
The Chinese president said during the past 5 years, the West has imposed a new set of hurdles that threaten to weigh down China's economic growth. The U.S. and its allies have imposed curbs on tech exports to China, prompting Beijing to double down on the need to shift away from imports for sectors perceived as vital to national security, including semiconductors and artificial intelligence. The U.S. is also working to expand its restrictions on the export of chipmaking equipment to China. Xi said China must have the courage to fight as the country faces profound and complex changes in both the domestic and international landscape. He urged private firms to take the initiative to pursue high-quality development.
I've always said there are two critical areas for China. One is to safeguard our rice bowl, and the other is to build up a strong manufacturing sector. As a great nation of 1.4 billion people, we must rely on ourselves. We can't depend on international markets to save us.
Earlier this week, Xi vowed to bolster China's manufacturing capacity and said the country should be able to fend for itself. Later, China's new foreign minister reiterated the president's forceful language on U.S. containment. He warned that conflict and confrontation with the U.S. is inevitable if Washington continues its reckless approach.
The United States claims to be competing to win against China rather than seeking a conflict. But in fact, the U.S. so-called competition is total containment and suppression, a zero-sum game in which you die and I live. If the U.S. does not hit the brakes but continues to speed down the wrong path, no amount of guardrails can prevent derailing. There will surely be conflict and confrontation.
The foreign minister also noted that the development of other countries would not undermine that of the U.S. Overall, the U.S. administration of Joe Biden has shown little interest in cooling tensions with China and frames its engagement with Chinese officials as managing of competition rather than an effort to resolve issues. In Washington, John Kirby, the White House national security spokesperson, brushed off the criticism and said the United States does not seek confrontation with Beijing. He said, "We seek a strategic competition with China. We do not seek conflict. We aim to compete and we aim to win that competition with China, but we absolutely want to keep it at that level." U.S. officials often speak of establishing guardrails in the bilateral relationship to prevent tensions from escalating into crises. Relations between Washington and Beijing deteriorated sharply after former U.S. President Donald Trump launched a trade war against China in 2018. China hoped for an improvement in relations under the administration of Joe Biden, but this never happened. The U.S. continued its hardline policies toward China under the Biden administration. China has repeatedly rebuked the U.S. for its growing nexus with Taiwan, as it regards the self-ruled island as its sovereign territory. The South China Sea, as well as the Ukraine war, are other sources of friction between Beijing and Washington. Bilateral relations soured further last month after a suspected Chinese spy balloon floated in American skies and was shot down by U.S. fighter jets. Beijing is critical of Washington's handling of the issue. According to some senior Republicans and U.S. military leaders, there is a growing concern that a full-scale conflict between the two superpowers is imminent, with the Asia-Pacific and South Asia regions likely to be the primary theaters of the conflict. That's because, besides boosting ties with Taiwan, the U.S. has also significantly increased its military activity in the South China Sea and other waters near Taiwan and China, causing Beijing to do the same, turning the region into a potential flashpoint for war.
Yeah. French President Emmanuel Macron has concluded his Africa tour, which took him to several countries, including Republic of Gabon, Angola, and the Democratic Republic of Congo. The ultimate goal? To restore the already tarnished image of France on the continent. In Gabon, this was obvious since day one. Some soldiers welcomed the arrival of the French president at the exit of the Libreville airport. But red, white, blue flags and the crowds on the road were absent all the way to the presidential palace. There, Macron participated with several African heads of state in a summit devoted to protecting tropical forests. In the Democratic Republic of Congo, Macron held talks with the country's president in capital Kinshasa, which last week saw several demonstrations in a sign of rising anti-French sentiment in parts of Africa. At a joint press conference, Macron acknowledged France was among foreign powers pushing for influence in Africa. He, however, said that he was committed to working with the African nations on an equal footing. Macron underlined that his country wants to be long-term partners to African countries, adding that the continent is a theater of competition. Macron's tour to Africa was his 18th visit to the continent. His trip follows a recent slew of African tours by high-level U.S., Russian, and Chinese officials seeking closer ties. France has endured a recent messy breakdown in relations with some former colonies in West Africa, and Macron's first-time visit to Gabon, Angola, and the Republic of Congo indicates his wish to turn the page. The French president last week outlined France's new Africa policy, saying military bases would be co-run with host nations and commercial and other interests pursued with respect and humility. France's new approach comes amid a deepening security crisis in West Africa's Sahel region that has fueled anti-French protests and brought juntas to power in several countries. While France is still trying to keep its hand on Africa, the anti-French sentiment has been high across the continent given the country's dark history there. From its genocide in Rwanda, Nigeria, Senegal, and a whole host of other nations, to its other crimes as part of its colonialist policies, all have prompted many in several countries to stand up against France's presence. Growing dissatisfaction with France is largely visible in other former colonies across Africa, including Mali. In Burkina Faso, anger against foreign presence can be clearly seen in nationwide protests, with demonstrators condemning the former colonizer. More broadly, the popular resentment against the West have been on the rise for the past several years due to their historic oppression on the continent. This has prompted many African nations to turn toward countries in the Eastern Bloc. The visit by a top Russian diplomat to South Africa recently, in an effort to refurbish the common pursuit of the two countries for upholding world peace and security, is among the many examples. With the summit of five emerging economies, commonly known as BRICS, in Africa this year, the idea of using the opportunity to push for the admission of new members to expand the bloc and challenge the global arrogance has taken momentum. Recent joint naval drills involving South Africa, Russia, and China, despite U.S. criticism, show these countries' resolve to stand against the global dominance of some powers. A change from unipolar to multipolar arrangements seems to be a necessity now for all African countries, especially for those in the East, which are embroiled in power politics. This major paradigm shift is undoubtedly achievable if countries across the continent join hand in hand in standing against the Western imperialism.
The Limelight.
The German authorities have searched a ship thought to have possibly transported explosives tied to the Nord Stream pipeline explosions, the German prosecutor's office said on Wednesday, 8th of March. The announcement came following media reports indicating pro-Ukrainian groups may have been responsible for the blasts. We take a look at the world media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The British newspaper The Guardian has covered this story and tells us more. The underwater bombing of the Nord Stream gas pipelines last September was carried out by a team of divers operating from a 15-metre chartered yacht called the Andromeda, according to a new report. The report in the German magazine Der Spiegel traces the Andromeda's route around the Baltic from its home marina in Rostock on 6th of September to the German island of Rügen, and then finally to the Danish island of Kristiansø, close to the site of the blast on 26th of September. Experts have questioned whether the amount of explosives used in the sabotage attacks, estimated to be several hundred kilograms of explosives, as well as with the necessary breathing apparatus and other equipment, could have been carried on such a small boat, raising the question of whether another vessel was involved. The German magazine Der Spiegel said that one of the six-person crew on the Andromeda was using a forged Bulgarian passport, but the German investigators have yet to identify the nationality of the bombers or attribute responsibility to any government. A New York Times report this week cited intelligence sources as saying a pro-Ukrainian group was involved, but German authorities have warned about the possibility of a false flag operation in which misleading clues are left deliberately to point in the wrong direction. The Ukrainian government has denied any involvement in the attack on the Nord Stream 1 and 2 pipelines, which were built to transport natural gas from Russia to Germany, and are majority-owned by the Russian state-owned company Gazprom. They were not operational at the time of the attack, which came 7 months after the start of the Russia-Ukraine conflict. But they were filled with natural gas, which bubbled to the surface, creating a wide area of visible turbulence. The German magazine Der Spiegel quotes a harbourmaster in Rügen Island as saying the group that hired the Andromeda were dressed like normal sailors, and that he saw them carrying shopping bags of provisions to the boat, speaking a language that sounded Polish or Czech to him. He said there were several men and a woman. The Andromeda is a Bavaria C-50, a sailing boat made by a German company, Bavaria Yachts. It has 5 cabins and room for up to 11 people. It has a platform at the back to dive from. At the site of the blast, the Baltic Sea is about 80 meters deep, requiring specialist diving skills and specialist air tanks, one with a helium-oxygen mixture and one with pure oxygen, the Spiegel report said. Each dive would have required the boat to be over the pipeline for about 3 hours. To have laid explosives on 2 pipelines 4 kilometers apart would probably have required 4 dives over a period of a few days. Diving experts say such extended deep dives would have required a decompression chamber for the divers, which would not fit on a small yacht. There are also questions on whether there would be room for the required explosives. The Danish and Swedish governments have said that the blasts were equivalent to the power of several hundred kilograms of explosives. Some experts say up to 2,000 kilograms would have been needed. We have been presented a piece of a puzzle. However, we don't know how big the puzzle is. It is 50 pieces, 500 or 5,000 pieces, said Christian Molling, the head of the Center for Security and Defense at the German Council on Foreign Relations. Was there a second boat and did somebody transport the explosives from somewhere else? Christian Molling asked. So that's why I think there are pieces of the puzzle missing for the moment. The chair of the Bundestag's Intelligence Oversight Committee Konstantin von Notz has warned the press to be as cautious as possible with any conclusions at this point in time. Konstantin von Notz told the German magazine Die Zeit the investigation was very likely to be dealing with a state or quasi-state actor because it is very demanding to transport large quantities of explosives, up to 2 tons are now being discussed, undetected to the right place in the Baltic Sea, to transport them into a relevant depth in order to trigger several explosions in a controlled manner. He said a state-backed act of terrorism makes it more likely than false or deceptive clues were laid. The German public prosecutor's office has said that a boat had been searched between 18th and 20th of January over suspicions it could have been used to transport explosive devices that exploded on 26th of September 2022. European and US intelligence officials have obtained tentative intelligence to suggest a pro-Ukrainian saboteur group may have been behind the bombing of the Nord Stream 1 and 2 pipelines last year, according to reports in the New York Times and the German newspaper Die Zeit. German newspaper Die Zeit has also covered this story and tells us more. European and US intelligence officials have obtained tentative intelligence to suggest a pro-Ukrainian saboteur group may have been behind the bombing of the Nord Stream 1 and 2 gas pipelines last year, according to reports in the New York Times and the German newspaper Die Zeit. German investigators believe the attack on the pipelines was carried out by a team of 6 people, including a yacht that had been hired by a company registered in Poland and owned by 2 Ukrainian citizens, according to the German newspaper Die Zeit. The information has been shared between the European intelligence agencies in an effort to establish more information about those who carried out the undersea bombings in September, an attack that had left Western governments perplexed. Details about the intelligence remaining sketchy, and it is unclear what confidence the US intelligence community places in the theory, as well as who may have organized the effort, funded or directed such a daring attack on the gas pipelines running between Russia and Germany. But it is suggested that the government of Kiev did not direct the underwater strike. Russia says it wanted an independent international inquiry to be set up in response to the report. Its deputy envoy to the United Nations said Moscow would call for a vote at the United Nations Security Council on whether to launch an international investigation. Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov on Wednesday, 8th of March, dismissed the US reports as a coordinated effort by the authors of the attack to divert attention. How can American officials assume anything without an investigation, said Dmitry Peskov, adding that Russia was still not allowed to be part of the investigation into this monstrous crime. Russia's embassy to the United States said on Wednesday, 8th of March, that leaks from U.S. intelligence services were no more than an attempt to confuse anybody who sincerely wishes to seek out the truth in this flagrant crime. It added, "It is simply a means of shifting suspicion from those in official government positions who ordered and coordinated the attacks in the Baltic Sea on the abstract individuals of some sort." A senior aide to Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky said the government in Kiev was in no way involved in the attack, which he said had no military impact on Russian forces. In the midst of a war, Ukraine and its allies would definitely not spend resources on something that would not bring us victory directly on the battlefield. It doesn't make any sense, but it is extremely beneficial for Russia itself to try to switch attention from the war and try to present itself as a kind of victim, he said. The attack took place in international waters in the Baltic Sea near the Danish island of Bornholm, with large amounts of gas rising up from the sea floor.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/parstodayen. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/parstodayenglish.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim.
Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood qudde saratani Israel mukhalifim.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
Wajh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is a part of the speech delivered by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, on October 3rd, 2022, during the joint graduation ceremony for the cadets studying in the academies of the Islamic Republic of Iran's armed forces. The ceremony was held in Imam Hassan al-Mushtaba alayhi salam University of Office and Police Training. These riots had been planned. If the incident with the young girl had not taken place, they have found another excuse to create insecurity and riots in the country in the beginning of the month of May, September, this year. Who designed these plans? I openly state that these schemes were designed by the US, the usurping fake Zionist regime, and their mercenaries. They sat down and planned. They devised these schemes. Their employees, mercenaries, wage earners, and some treasonous Iranians abroad helped them. Sometimes when I say a certain event was planned by a foreign enemy, some are very sensitive to the term foreign enemy when I say such and such was the work of foreigners. It was carried out by foreign enemies. Some quickly jumped to the defense of the US and Zionist intelligence services. They use all sorts of fallacious analysis and rhetoric to try to show that foreigners were not in any way involved in that event.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Rights
Riots take place all the time around the world. If you look at Europe, especially France, massive riots occur every now and then on the streets of Paris. I want to ask you, has the US President or the US House of Representatives ever supported European rioters? Have they ever issued a statement saying, "We stand with you"? Is there any record of the mass media, which is affiliated with American capitalism, the US government and their mercenaries, like some of the governments in the region, unfortunately, such as the Saudi government? Is there any record of them supporting the rioters? Is there any record of them announcing that they will provide the hardware or that software for the internet and put it at the disposal of rioters so that they can easily communicate with each other and carry out their plans? Is there a history of such a thing happening anywhere in the world, in any country? But it happened here, and not just once or twice. It has happened many times, over and over again.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Iruba Shavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pourreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
Iran's Shahid Rudaki warship, an unlikely but definitely meaningful location to hold the closing ceremony of the 17th International Resistance Film Festival.
Now, in these days, you know that the films are more important even than the books. So it's very important for us to make people to know about our beliefs, also our artists and our filmmakers.
It helps us to give information through movies to our children about Islam, about Palestine, people, how they suffer. Someone just see a movie and starts crying after seeing what happens in Palestine, in Yemen, in Syria, through movies.
In these films, or what we're doing about drama and films, we want to give message. And our message to the Israel, that if you kill him, our people, we will speak about this.
In my opinion, resistance movies are mostly about war because they show that we have to fight to survive. We have to fight for our rights. And this is the most important message of resistance movies.
Making resistance movies is not just about sending a message, which of course is an important part of the whole issue, but everything about this genre is also a challenge. Consider the special effects, the computer graphics, the stunts, the cinematography in general. This genre turns a filmmaker into an expert.
2 kilometers away off the coast, the offshore closing ceremony on the blue waters of the Persian Gulf awarded the best resistance movies in several sections, including documentaries, animations, and short and feature-length movies. As expected, The Stranger, a movie directed by Mohammad Hossein Latifi that depicts the life of the IRGC commander Mohammad Burujerdi, swept most of the awards, while The Situation of Mahdi and The Mudroom came in next. But the success of an up-and-coming young female director definitely stole the show. Leyli Aj impressed the jury with her first movie, Colonel Soraya, a must-see, according to movie critics, that depicts the notorious terrorist group MKO.
The festival has been doing very well. So as a filmmaker, I feel proud that veteran filmmakers in the jury have found my film worthy of the Best Picture Award. Now this makes my job more difficult because expectations are high.
The main reason to produce films is to bring impact to people's lives, to bring change in people's lives. As a religious student, one of the best ways to preach